You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Well, the JSE bucked the window dressing script of quarter close yesterday, breaking a three-day winning streak and losing the most in a single day since mid-March. Still, this is no April Fool's joke. The local bourse gained nearly 12% in the first quarter of 2021, marking the best first quarter on the JSE in 15 years and making it the best performing market in the world. This as progress is being made to alleviate the Eskom crisis, but also while we are awaiting a proper vaccine rollout. And the large US stimulus package has obviously boosted global sentiment, with investors believing that the global economy might recover sooner than expected. For much of the first quarter, though, volatility in equity markets was triggered by a surge in US Treasury yields as investors anticipate high inflation as a result of the stimulus package. US markets closed out the quarter with gains. The S&P 500 rose 5.8%, the Dow 7.8%. Over the 3 months, though, the 4.1% quarterly rise in the MSCI World was the slowest since the recovery from last March's meltdown. And this has come with growing concern about hiccups in the vaccine rollout and a fresh wave of coronavirus infections, particularly in Europe, where on Wednesday we saw France ordering a third national lockdown. Overnight, US President Joe Biden introduced a $2 trillion infrastructure plan for the United States, one that's designed to establish the US as a global leader on climate change, with an overhaul of the transport sector, energy, construction, and several others. The American Jobs Plan looks set to add fuel to the inflation fire. Well, to get a handle on the animal spirits, I'm joined now by Chris Holdsworth, Chief Investment Strategist at Investec Wealth and Investment. Chris, welcome. As we head into the Easter break, the President has reminded us that the path of the next wave is in our hands. What are we seeing globally? Because it does look rather worrying.
Now, the global numbers at this point are fairly concerning, Michael. It's evident that there is another wave underway. Pretty much wherever you look, every major region around the world has seen a recent increase in the number of new infections. The European numbers up about 14% week on week. The US, South America, African numbers all up about 12% week on week. And Asia is particularly concerning, up about 33%. And that's because India is up about 50%. So it's quite clear that there is a new wave pretty much everywhere around the world. With the exception of South Africa, we seem to have dodged the bullet so far. Our numbers are still very modest, and hence the reason for concern around Easter. And given that it's happening everywhere else, it's quite likely that it will happen here at some point. And the best that we can do at this point is delay it.
What are we actually seeing in South Africa in terms of numbers?
Our seven-day average is still sitting at just above 1,000 infections per day. It's not materially different from where it was a week ago, in fact, 2 weeks ago. So our numbers are bottoming. They're fairly steady along that sort of level, at just around 1,000 or so. So it's still pretty good at this point.
At this point, and that's why there is so much concern about what happens over Easter with the potential of a super spreader event around Maria in particular. That worries me. Globally, what is the vaccine rollout dashboard telling us about this race to get to immunity, herd immunity?
Globally, about 4% of the global population has received at least one injection, one vaccine so far. So we're about 4% behind the global average. But individual places have done a lot better. Gibraltar is close to 100% vaccinated already. The UK is sitting at over 40% already, and shortly they'll be vaccinating people just over the age of 30. The US is at about 27%, and Europe's at about 11%. But what we have noticed at various countries is, as the vaccine starts to get rolled out, it does seem to associate with another wave. Perhaps it's behavioral. We say perhaps because no one knows for sure, but as the vaccine's rolled out, perhaps people become a bit more relaxed. It's what we saw in Chile. It may be what we're seeing in the US. And then you get another little wave before you get to herd immunity. And let's hope it's just one more wave.
And that is instructive for us here in South Africa, as we are hoping to go into our second phase from around mid to end April, if Business for South Africa are to be believed. We've got the Johnson & Johnson vaccines arriving, and we need to be cautious that when we start vaccinating people, we don't drop our guard until we've reached that level of over 60% of the population vaccinated. Obviously, the big theme as we wrap up the first quarter and we look ahead for the rest of the year has been inflation. What are inflation expectations tracking at currently?
The broad expectation, the average expectation, that inflation will be about 2.5% per annum over the next decade. And that by itself will be fine, because the Fed has indicated that they'd be willing to allow inflation to breach 2% for a sustained period, because there's some catch-up that needs to occur. And they're focusing on employment, which we can talk about shortly. And if it just follows the market expectation, that'd be okay. The issue is the probability of an extreme event. And what the market is currently pricing in is about a 30% chance that inflation averages 3% per annum for the next decade, which would be materially above the Fed's expectations. And therefore, at some point, you'll end up with a hike or a taper tantrum of sorts. And when the Fed starts to signal that they are going to take their foot off the accelerator and potentially even put their foot on the brake, we can expect to see some volatility in the market. And the question is whether that's in the next 12 months or the next 24 months. And at this point, it is an open question. We're fairly certain that inflation is coming. We expect that the inflation print in May alone will be above 3%. The question is whether it's sustained at above 3% or not. And the market is saying there's about a 30% chance that that will be the case.
And it's interesting because in the Bank of America fund manager survey recently, there was a question about what 10-year treasury yield causes a 10% equity correction. And the answer was around 2%. And you say now the expectations are around 3%. So that seems to indicate that we might see a significant pullback in equities if we do hit that mark.
Yeah, if you go back over the very long run, it seems to be the case that there's a sweet spot for equities with inflation at and around 3% or so. And when it gets materially above that, that's when you start to get jitters in the market. So 3% or so would be okay. Bear in mind that real rates are still quite negative. So you can have inflation of 3%, a negative real rate of about 1%, and then a long bond yield of about 2%, because the long bond yield is inflation expectations plus the real rate. So inflation expectations of 3% is fairly consistent with a long bond yield of 2%. The issue for the market is if those numbers become much higher.
Yeah, and what yield on the 10-year makes bonds attractive relative to stocks? And I suppose you've just sketched out that sort of scenario. Now, we have seen some surprise hikes by emerging markets recently, Chris. Is this trying to preempt the Fed and where inflation is going? Are these just country-specific hikes? Because you think of the likes of Russia and Brazil here. What's going on there?
No, you're completely correct. So Russia, Brazil, and Turkey have all hiked quite recently. And in the statements, if we read through them, it's quite clear that they're concerned about inflation as it is. They're seeing high inflation numbers now, but also the prospect of higher inflation, and they're wanting to preempt that. And that is very much against the grain of what we're seeing in most places around the world. The Fed has been absolutely adamant that they are not concerned about inflation now. They know that some inflation is going to be increasing, but they do not believe it will be sustained. And as a result, they're guiding that they're not going to be hiking anytime soon, at best some point at the end of next year or maybe even 2023. And the ECB is similarly saying that they're unlikely to be hiking anytime soon. And the SARB has guided that they certainly won't be hiking soon. They might be hiking later, given their quarterly projection model. So it's very much against the grain. It does seem to be country specific. But what that means is that we are starting to see some dispersion in short rates with some countries, developed markets in particular, South Africa, a few other emerging markets, keeping rates flat and committing to keeping rates flat for at least the next few months. And then you've got some emerging markets coming through hiking already because of concerns about their currencies and higher inflation.
Yeah, and a lot of that, and we're going to come to it a little bit later, is also being driven by the oil price increase that we've seen lately. How sustainable that is? Well, I think there's a lot of debate around exactly where the oil price is going to be heading because of the ESG theme and electric vehicles and all of that. On the employment front, Chris, I think no one I know thinks that the unemployment numbers in the US here reflect reality. And it's important when we think of inflation and interest rates. Even Jerome Powell believes it's deeply understated. And he said so in a speech last month. You count as unemployed if you actively look for work. And Powell says, and I think correctly, millions want to work, but for various reasons haven't been looking. So they don't count and the unemployment rate is artificially low. And you can imagine now vaccination progress, bringing the virus under control and hopefully soon in the US, the economy should begin recovering as consumers gain confidence again. And among those gaining confidence will be some of those millions presently out of the labor force. And once they start actively looking, the unemployment rate may well rise, even though the economy is improving. So the data sometimes is misleading. But what are we seeing in the data?
This is the reason why the Fed is unlikely to be hiking in the short term, even if inflation breaches 2% over the next few months. In the US, we've got the advantage of some pretty granular, high-frequency data. We can estimate what unemployment is for different levels of income. We can get unemployment for the low end all the way up to the top end. And if we examine that data, it's quite interesting. Employment at the top end, those are people earning more than $85,000 per annum, is back to where it was pre-COVID. In fact, it's slightly above. Employment for the low end in the US, which is people earning less than $30,000 per annum, is still about 10 to 15% below pre-COVID levels. And the Fed has emphasized that they are concerned about employment at the low end in particular. So in their minds, they've got two things to balance. On the one hand is what they believe will be a temporary spike in inflation, and on the other hand, sustained low levels of employment for the low end. And the trade-off that they're making in their mind at this point is to say, we'll ride through the current levels of inflation when it picks up, and we think it will be temporary, and we think it will come down, and we'll do so such that we can support the economy to ensure that low-end employment picks up. So it's a focus on growth and employment more than inflation. It's a change in sentiment. They announced this last year, and it does mean that we get rates lower for longer in the US.
Now, Chris Holdsworth, the other big news story this last month was the beaching of the Ever Given in the Suez Canal, a ship that sparked 1,000 memes. What impact has this had on global trade and supply chains?
Well, the major impact is that it's drawn into sharp focus the vulnerabilities of supply chains around the world. But that problem is being resolved, and it'll be fairly short term. There are deeper global issues that require attention as well. As an example, the Fed conducts regional surveys around the US where they speak to manufacturers and they ask them about their outlook for the year ahead and how their activity has picked up. But they also ask them about lead times for getting equipment delivered and the backlog of orders. And if we look at those regional surveys, what it tells us is that the backlog of orders, this is pre the blockage in the Suez Canal, the backlog of orders in the US is at a record high. Lead times are at a record high. It's taking an increasingly long amount of time to get things delivered. And that is the key distinction between this crisis and the global financial crisis. When we came out of the global financial crisis, there hadn't been a big mix-up of supply chains. And as a result, as demand picked up, supply could pick up quite swiftly as well. The key point for this crisis is as things progress and as the vaccine is rolled out and activity starts to pick up, it seems to be the case that the binding constraint on growth is shifting from demand to supply. And if that is the case, and we're landing up with these lead times being as long as they are and the backlogs being as high as they are, that means we should be penciling in higher prices. And it may well be the case that inflation expectations are too low because it's going to take some time for the supply side to catch up to increasing demand.
And that is another an alarming stoke of that inflationary fire that is already burning away in the background. So we'll be paying very close attention to that over the next month and quarter in particular. Now, many in the hospitality sector, I think, are going to be hoping for an Easter boost in travel and spend. What are you tracking in terms of the recovery in hotel and leisure?
Yeah, we keep a very close eye on the sector globally for two primary reasons. The one is that it is a large part of the global economy. For various countries, it's 2 to 3% of GDP. In some countries, it's up to 10% of GDP. But in addition to that, in the US, a lot of the low end is employed, particularly in hotel and leisure. It accounts for about 10% of total employment. So when this sector starts to recover, we will see the low end employment start to pick up. And at that point, the Fed will feel comfortable that they can hike. So it is a sector that one needs to track very closely. And at this point, there is a fairly sharp recovery underway. Hotel occupancy in the US is up to about 60%, which is up 7% week on week. Now, that's materially better than where it was in January, but there is still a long way to go before we'll get back to normal levels. We're still about 15% or so behind what happened in the global financial crisis. So a long way to go, but rapid recovery. But we track various data points. It's not just hotel occupancy, but also the number of people passing through TSA security, the people that want to get on airplanes and fly around. In January, that number was about 650,000 people per day. It's now doubled to where it is now, about 1.4 million per day. It has to nearly double again before we'll get back to historic levels. But the point is it has recently doubled. And that large gap that we've seen between current levels and what happened in 2019 is being eroded fairly rapidly. So we're seeing a fairly swift recovery. Now, if we were to try to estimate when do we get back to pre-COVID levels, we can first of all make reference to what happened in 2001, where it took 3 to 4 years for global tourism activity to recover post 9/11. But secondly, there are a bunch of surveys that have been conducted around the world by the United Nations asking professionals in the space, tourism operators, government officials, when you think international tourism will get back to pre-COVID levels. And the consensus view seems to be that another 2 to 3 years or so. Which implies that we're seeing a fairly swift recovery. That recovery will probably slow from this point, and there's a long grind to go before we're going to get back to pre-COVID levels.
It's interesting, dovetailing with comments that I was watching last night on Bloomberg from the CEO of Tinder, who said it's still too early to tell whether or not from the activity that they're seeing on the app, we're going to see a summer of love in the Northern Hemisphere as vaccine rollouts continue to gather pace and people are confident enough to go out and start dating again. It is all about confidence to take those trips and to go into large hotels and crowded tourist destinations as well. The US housing market is another barometer that we look at regularly, and it's looking really good at the moment, Chris.
Yeah, this is a sector that one has to be completely familiar with if one wants to have a view on global consumption. Because Americans do what South Africans do as well. It's often the case they will extract equity from their home. So home prices go up, they will go and get a new bond on their home, and they will convert that into buying flat screen TVs and new vehicles and the like. So it's a critical indicator of U.S. household consumption. Last year, U.S. households extracted about $180 billion worth of equity from their homes. So we need to have a firm view of what's happening there. And the latest data is quite good. There were quite a few headlines that came out lately about how there had been fewer homes purchased in February than January, suggesting that there was a softening of the U.S. housing market. But one needs to look at prices rather than simply the number of homes that went through. And price activity is very strong. We can look at high frequency data looking at the median price of homes that were traded. And for early March, that number's up about 15% year on year. It's extraordinarily strong house price growth. We haven't seen growth like this for some time. And more than that, we can look at other indicators to further confirm the strength of the US housing market. For every home that was sold in February, there were four offers made. It very much is a seller's market at this point in the US, with the listing price often not being sufficient to get a trade. So at this point, the US housing market is in rude health.
And that is good read-through for the American consumer. And the American economy is set to get another boost from the infrastructure program that was announced by Joe Biden overnight. $2 trillion in government spending into U.S. infrastructure, alongside $2 trillion in higher corporate taxes in the first stage of a multi-trillion dollar effort to reshape the world's largest economy. The plan includes multiple changes to the tax code, things like raising the corporate tax rate to 28% from the current 21%, which is a big jump, closing corporate global minimum tax loopholes, implementing tax changes to discourage offshoring and eliminate tax breaks for the fossil fuel industry. So at least it's sort of fiscally neutral for the US, but what impact are you modeling this increase in taxes to have on earnings?
Yeah, you're completely right. This is massive. If we look at the recent changes that we've seen to earnings expectations and growth expectations, a lot of it has been on the back of an increase in stimulus. But at some point, the piper needs to be paid. So there will be an increase in tax as well. We've done some preliminary analysis. We'll get more detail as this package moves through the congressional process. But the preliminary estimate is that the increase in corporate taxes alone, that's not the increases in personal income tax, just the corporate tax increases, should shave about 9% of S&P 500 earnings in a year and a half's time. So the trade-off in our mind is, on the one hand, we get extra stimulus that boosts demand, that should see improvement to earnings, but we do need to recognize that there's a cost on the other side, and our earliest estimate is that cost is about 9% of earnings, which is a big number.
But the trade-off, Chris, I mean, and we're having the conversation here in South Africa, is that infrastructure is gross fixed capital formation. It's sinking money and capital into things, network industries, that should ultimately improve the efficiency of the economy, which should, in the medium to long term, really be positive for South African US and South African consumers if we can get our infrastructure program going. But for now, it should be positive for the US consumer and for US companies.
Absolutely. And there's a need for infrastructure investment, not just in the US, but globally. I mean, there are a number of dams in Japan that are well over 80 to 90 years old. In the US, the average age of a dam is somewhere over 40 years old. I forget the exact number at this point. So they need to re-look at those dams. The older dams get, the more they require maintenance. So there needs to be a rollout of maintenance. You need to do it for bridges, for roads. One can make the argument that high-speed trains should be operating in the US as they are in China, and we're not seeing them. So there's an opportunity for investment in rail as well. And there's all sorts of blockages to supply chains that need to be addressed, ports as well. So there's huge scope for investment, and it may well improve the long-term outlook for growth. We do just need to recognize that there may well be a cost associated with that, And that is something we do need to account for.
Turning to closer to home now, we're facing massive petrol price increases next week. We've got the fuel levy, obviously the rising oil price. What impact do you expect this to start having on local inflation?
And the inflation print came out last week at just below 3%, and we think that's low for inflation. It is now going to be increasing. And based on the model that we use, we're expecting inflation in May, so it'll come out in June, but the May inflation print to be a bit above 5%, and for June to be above 5% as well. And we're a bit higher than most others. The SARB expects inflation to get to up to just below 5% for Q2. The consensus forecast is a bit below that. So we do think that inflation expectations at this point in South Africa are probably too low, but we don't think inflation is going to breach 6%. And if it does, it won't do it for long. So while we do think inflation is going to be picking up from this point, we don't think that will be sufficient to see an interest rate hike, which is different from the market. The market is pricing in 3 to 4 interest rate hikes over the next 12 months. Mm. And that's something that we disagree with. We don't think we're going to follow Brazil, Russia, and Turkey's example in hiking rates now. We think we're going to take a slower approach. We'll follow the guidance from the Fed. And since they're not going to be hiking anytime soon, and our inflation prints are still below 6% and likely to be below 6%, and growth is still fairly tepid at this point in South Africa, we don't think that the SARB is going to hike anytime soon.
Interesting that, because that's the feeling that I got in the sense from the recent MPC meeting. Lesetha Kanyago pointed to the QPM. He said, this is what the model is saying. It's predicting 225 bips increases, but we're also going to be very mindful of other data. And the feedback is that the South African economy is still very weak. So I didn't get the impression that even though they were unanimous in their decision to hold rates and they weren't split on two wanted to cut and three holding, I did get the sense that the SARB was going to wait a little longer. So I tend to agree with that house view as well. The longer term outlook for oil demand, though, let's come back to that, because there's an interesting debate happening in markets at the moment, as we've seen oil prices rise in the first quarter of this year, that this cannot be sustained. We're already seeing the shale revolution keeping a lid on prices, and the shale rigs are going full tilt again. But there's a bigger macro driver here. Just take me through your view on oil prices from here.
Now, this is something it's completely fascinating, and we are living in an environment which is going to see potentially peak oil demand either happening now or even the last couple of years. And I'll run you through the thinking behind that. The first is the advent of electric vehicles. And the IEA forecast is that electric vehicles, or the global fleet, will reach about 60 million vehicles by 2026, so in 5 years' time. That alone will shave about 1.5 million barrels per day off global oil demand. In addition to that, you've got continuing improvements in efficiency for vehicles around the world. Miles per gallon are increasing, so cars are becoming more efficient. And we can track the efficiency of fleets in the US, in India, and various other countries, and we can see how that has progressed over the past few years. And the changes have been massive. So if you combine the rollout of EVs and the improvement in efficiency, it looks like for OECD countries in particular, we've already passed peak oil demand. It's done. That was 2019. Oil demand collapsed in 2020. It's starting to recover now, but we don't think for OECD countries, the developed market countries, it gets back to 2019 levels. The counterbalance, though, is what's happening in emerging markets. Mm. We're sure there's an EV rollout as well, and cars are becoming more efficient, but the reality is you have an increasing middle class. And so you still land up with more internal combustion engines out and about. And what that means is you land up with increasing oil demand from countries like China and India, offsetting the gains that we're seeing in OECD countries. So you can run through various scenarios with regards to the adoption of EVs, the taxes from various countries on carbon emissions. And under the most optimistic scenario, we've already passed peak oil demand. If you change the scenarios a bit, then oil demand continues to increase over the next few years. But the point is, for the first time, probably the last 100 years, we're now at a point where there is a material probability that we have passed peak oil demand.
Fascinating. Chris Holdsworth, the Chief Investment Strategist at Investec Wealth and Investments, with your animal spirits in April.